The Civil Justice Subcommittee will come to order. Julia, please call the roll.
Chair Robinson.
Here.
Vice Chair Snyder.
Here.
Ranking Member Arrington. Representatives Beltran.
Here.
Black.
Here.
Campbell has been excused. Chamberlain.
Here.
Daniels. Gant.
Here.
Coster.
Here.
Lopez.
Here.
Maggard.
Here.
Maney.
Here.
McFarland.
Here.
Overdorf.
Yes, ma'am.
Roth.
Here.
Saroy.
Here.
Smith.
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Julia. I want to remind everyone to please silence their cell phones. Also, as a reminder for our members, please ensure that you turn your microphone on when you're speaking and off when you're finished. I also request that you please fill out a public appearance card if you intend to speak before the committee. Today we have 10 bills and 6 amendments, so we're going to be busy members today. But first up, HB 29, Representative Benjamin. I thought you were here. Oh, there you are. You're almost an honorary member of this subcommittee, as many bills as have come last couple of years. Sir, you are recognized to present HB 29.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vice Chair Snyder, Ranking Member Arrington, members of the committee, it is indeed a honor to be before you again. Last year, or actually two sessions ago, we passed a bill that increased the automobile exemption for consumer debt relief from $1,000 to $5,000. We conditioned this exemption for bankruptcy filings. It did make it to the governor's desk, but the governor feeling that this exemption should apply in general and not just for bankruptcies, vetoed that bill. And so we've brought this bill back to do exactly what the governor has asked us to do and make it applicable generally to consumer debt collections. And so we're asking that the automobile exemption that we get for consumer debt collections be raised from $1,000 to $5,000. And that is the bill.
Any questions for Representative Benjamin, HB 29? Seeing none, do we have any public appearance cards? We have no amendments. We have none. Members, any debate? Any debate on HB 29? Seeing none, Representative Benjamin, you're recognized to close your bill.
Wave close.
Having waived close on his bill, Julia, please call the roll on HB 29 and announce the vote.
Representatives Arrington.
Yes.
Beltran.
Yes.
Black.
Yes.
Campbell has been excused. Chamberlain.
Yes.
Daniels. Gant.
Yes.
Coster.
Yes.
Lopez. Maggard.
Yes.
Maney.
Yes.
McFarland.
Yes.
Overdorf.
Yes, ma'am.
Roth.
Yes.
Saroy.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Chair Robinson.
Yes.
15 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Please show HB 29 reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You're right there. So HB 175, judgment liens. Representative Benjamin, you're recognized to present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, committee, this bill came before you last year, and it was passed. It went to the governor's desk and was signed. After it going into action, we determined that there were some glitches that needed to be fixed. And this bill addresses those glitches and provides some clarity in those areas for which there was clarity needed. And that's the bill.
Any questions? Any questions for Representative Benjamin on his bill? Seeing none, we have an amendment. Representative Benjamin, you're recognized to explain amendment barcode 654281.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment clarifies that an inactive filing of a judgment certificate doesn't preclude the later filing of that judgment certificate. And that is the amendment.
Any questions on the amendment? Members, no questions. Do we have any public appearance cards? Professor Jeff Davis, Business Law Section of the Florida Bar, waves in support. Thank you, sir. Appreciate you coming. That's all I have. Members, we are in debate on the amendment. Any debate? Representative Benjamin, you're recognized to close on your amendment.
Thank you. Waive close on amendment.
Having waived close, please find that amendment adopted without objection. We're back on the bill as amended. Any public appearance cards on the bill as amended? Kenneth Pratt, Florida Bankers Association, waves in support. Professor Jeff Davis, Business Law Section of Florida Bar, waves in support. That's all the public appearance cards we have. Members, we are in debate. Any members wishing to debate? Seeing none, Representative Benjamin, you're recognized to close in your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with those ringing endorsements from the bankers and the business section of the Florida Bar, who enjoyed their assistance with this bill, I do close. Thank you.
Representative Benjamin, having closed in his bill, Julia, please call the roll on HB 175 and announce the vote.
Representatives Arrington.
Yes.
Beltran.
Yes.
Black.
Yes.
Campbell has been excused. Chamberlain.
Yes.
Daniels.
Yes.
Gant.
Yes.
Coster.
Yes.
Lopez.
Yes.
Maggard.
Yes.
Maney.
Yes,
ma'am. McFarland.
Yes.
Overdorf.
Yes, ma'am.
Roth.
Yes.
Saroy.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Ex officio Gottlieb.
Yes.
Chair Robinson.
Yes.
18 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Please show the bill reported favorably as amended. Congratulations. And welcome Representative Gottlieb to our esteemed subcommittee as ex officio. Next up, HB 283, self-storage facility liens by Representative Barrero. Representative, you're recognized to explain the bill.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. So right now, under Florida law, if a landlord is going to effectuate a lien sale on the tenant for a self-storage facility, he has to either advertise it in a newspaper of general circulation or in a physical place somewhere in the neighborhood. Very antiquated and obsolete means of advertising or giving notice to the tenant. So what this bill does is it allows the landlord or the storage owner to advertise that sale in a place that's commonly used for sale of these units. That is a bill.
Members, questions on the bill? Representative Gant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barrero, I just want to clarify. The newspaper, it's not an either or with the website or the newspaper, it's both.
Representative Barrero, you're recognized.
So under the bill, it will require or. So a landlord could publish it as it is right now under a newspaper of general circulation, or he may publish it via online, like at an online auction.
Further question, Representative Gant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are some examples of these websites?
Representative Barrero, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. I don't know all of the names. I think one of them is storagewars.com. There's a couple of places that are posted on you know, where you can post them online.
Representative Gant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If a website is chosen, would there be a notice provision in the contract that's signed for the renters to know that it can be a newspaper or a website, just so that they are aware?
Representative Barrero, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. As a matter of fact, yes, that will be required with the bill.
Thank you. Further questions? Seeing none, Representative Barrero, you're recognized to explain Amendment Barcode 963517.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you for you and your staff for working me on this to allow additional notice and additional protection for the tenants. This amendment requires that the actual website that would be used for the sale of the unit would be included in the contract between the landlord and the tenant, so they'll know where it would be posted.
Questions on the amendment? Seeing no questions, any public appearance cards on the amendment? Anna Higgins, Self-Storage Association, is a proponent. Waves in support. Members, we are in debate on the amendment. Anyone wishing to debate on the amendment? Representative Barrero, you're recognized to close in your amendment.
Wave close.
Having waived close, we will show that amendment adopted without objection. We're back on the bill as amended and public appearance cards. Sam Morley, Florida Press Association. Sir, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members, for the time. I'm Sam Morley, Florida Press Association, General Counsel. We believe that the practical result of the bill will actually be the elimination of newspaper notice for the self-storage liens. The public policy reason for such notice, newspaper notice, is that such notice provides transparency, thereby keeping seizures and auctions from happening in secrecy, keep in mind that this is a non-judicial, no oversight, private process, no judges involved. So providing the notice to the public, facility owners introduce transparency into the commercial arrangement that is otherwise one-sided. This notice improves the chances that when personal notice has failed or the facility has erred, an action will be noticed by the public, and any wrong will be averted. More transparency, not less, better protects property owners and the public. Newspapers provide transparency because large sectors of the public still rely on the print newspaper and expect public notice to be there. I'd like to bring to your attention some research polling done by Mason-Dixon Polling and Research. This has been conducted over the last few years. The most recent was done just a few weeks ago, and it shows that 8 in 10 Floridians say that state and local governments should be required to publish public notices in the newspaper on a regular basis. According to the same study, almost 6 in 10 Floridians were unlikely to seek out public notices if they were posted on a government website or not available in a printed or online newspaper. We think the number would be higher if they were forced to rely on an obscure auction website like the one in this current bill. So we believe these numbers show that the public agrees that putting notices on government and private websites like those in the bill will significantly reduce notice to citizens and will diminish, not add to, transparency in the process. So I appreciate your time.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Ron Book, I believe that says Gannett News Chain. You have wonderful handwriting, sir.
I didn't get an A in penmanship, Mr. Chairman. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm here on behalf of not only Gannett News Chain, which I represent all 23 of their newspapers statewide, but here on behalf of the Florida Press Association as well. You know, for the last 3 years or four, we find ourselves in the print world back in front of you because we continue to want to beat up on the press. I respect it. You have that right. First Amendment. But chipping away at public notice as a form of message to the print media does nothing for your constituents. I would simply say to you, picture the following. Picture frozen embryos. Forget that traditional storage warehouse where we might store our jet skis, where we might store our files, where we might store, if you will, in between move to move, or our family's inheritances, because we have no other place for them. But think about frozen embryos. You know how they're treated under Florida law? They're real property. So when the woman and the man, husband and wife, harvest the eggs, doctor, IVF specialist, creates embryos. The woman has one embryo, two embryos, three embryos, depending on whether she wants single child, twins, triplets. They insert the embryos. The balance of the embryos go to a cryogenics facility if the family wants to maintain the balance of the eggs or the embryos. So what happens, which is oftentimes what happens with warehouse storage, I run my credit card. Now, I can't speak for the rest of you, but I've spent the last 7 years with identity theft. Representative Gottlieb is aware of that. 7 years. Every time I get a new credit card, it gets cloned within a week. My information's posted on the dark web. I get phone calls from all over the country, from credit unions, credit card companies, and commercial banks. Been going on for 7 years. So I have a new credit card. And I didn't notify the cryogenics warehouse. So what happens? They call me. They miss me. Well, if they want to destroy the embryos or put them up for auction or sell them to somebody, I could be the recipient of lost embryos because I didn't see a public notice. Folks, You have chipped away at advertising options for cities and counties. And to my friend, dear Representative Barrero, who I consider to be a personal friend, it is with hesitation I stood up today because of my relationship. But folks, when you do this, and your mother or your father or your aunt or your uncle or your cousins or your brothers or your sisters knock on your door to tell you they missed the printed notice because they didn't run a printed notice in the newspaper, because the warehouse company decided this alternative method, and all my photos that I stored there, that are a lifetime of photos and antiques and embryos, is that really what we want to do? And I say that most respectfully, Representative Barrero, Mr. Chairman, you want to say and, but not or? That works just fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Ann Higgins, Self-Storage Association. I believe I have you signed up twice, so I'll just let you speak
sorry.
Once. That's all right. No. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Anna Higgins, and I am standing here in support of this bill on behalf of our client, Self-Storage Association. What I want to bring up is some of the things that were addressed here. In practice, an owner of a storage facility attempts to contact a delinquent tenant lots of different times, because what ends up happening is if they go to lien sale, they lose money. It is beneficial to the owner to make sure they exhaust all avenues of contact with that tenant rather than go to a lien sale. So that is what they do. And this bill also offers an alternative contact to be listed in the contract so that that person is also notified if the original tenant is unable to be located. So Florida law currently requires that the operator advertise a sale in a newspaper of general circulation, as Rep. Barrero mentioned, twice before conducting it. So newspapers, as we all know, were once the most effective means to advertise upcoming sales and drive traffic to it. That is no longer the case. Storage sales have shifted to online platforms over the last several years. Those online auction websites are now the most effective platforms to advertise these upcoming sales. And to date, 32 states have adopted an advertising method like what is contained in this bill, or they don't have an advertising method at all. And the bill, like I said, is going to bolster consumer protection, but the online advertisement, as you know, this legislature has allowed local governments for different legal notices to also advertise online, because this legislature has recognized that as good policy and an effective way to communicate with the person who is in need of that notice. So just to reiterate, the storage facility owner would much rather be able to contact this tenant and have their payment up to date than go to a lien sale. Really, the lien sales rarely bring in even 25 to 30% of the outstanding debt. So it's in their best interest, and this bill is very protective of the consumer and the tenant, or the tenant, however you want to look at it. So I thank you all in advance for your support of this good bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we're in debate. Ranking Member Arrington, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative, for reaching out to me in regards to this bill. And my apologies, because I was going to be up on it today because of some of the testimony. And I really wish I would have heard from those folks before today to hear what those issues are, but because of those, I will be down today, but maybe if we can put the word and rather than or in there before the next stop, I would love to be up. Thank you so much.
I believe I saw Representative Gantz hand up. You're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Rep. Barrero, I appreciate you reaching out. I was kind of late in reading my bills for this committee, but in reading it, it's the or that gave me reason to pause. simply because, well, the economic part of it for newspapers, one, and two, everyone doesn't use the website or the internet. Everyone doesn't use the internet. And so my hesitation is, what websites, or would it be a general notice that it could be on a website, and would consumers be required to do a search that isn't really specific in the notice? And so having had a nightmare situation with the probate case where the family had no idea what their deceased family members had, and then they found out that they had a storage, and going through that process with the storage company, it was a nightmare for me as an attorney and for the family, and the newspaper helped with that. So if you are amenable to changing it from or to and, I will be able to support it. But in the posture that the bill is now, I wouldn't be able to support it.
Madam Gottlieb, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to be down on the bill now today, Representative Barrero. And here's the reason why. I think that the storage facilities can build in the cost of advertising, and that seems like this is what this is about. And if it's correct that they want to get back to whole as quickly as possible, I would think you would want to advertise it in more places. But I think what you do is you just build into your contract that if there is a cost in advertising, that cost has to be borne by the person who purchases the new unit. They take it essentially subject to a lien. I think it can be cured that way. And I think that's something that they should explore so that everybody involved gets their appropriate due process and has the opportunity to know that perhaps there's a unit that's up for auction.
Representative Beltran, you recognize the debate.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Rep. Barrero, for this bill. I do want to respond to something that was said in public comment. And Mr. Book certainly always earns his retainer. He comes in with a lot of passion and comes up with some very clever arguments. But I do want to respond to those arguments that he made. And it was a very clever argument he made that essentially talking about the most valuable possible thing that could be stored, which is a human embryo, a fertilized embryo. And I know Rep. Barrero shares my feelings about the sanctity of life and the value of life. And so that's a very compelling example. And it goes back, I think, 6 years ago we had this debate. It was my first session here in the legislature. And one of my colleagues, someone came up and said, if you don't get the notice, your most valuable possessions could be lost. And one of my colleagues came up with a rejoinder to that, as if your possessions are so valuable, why'd you keep them in the storage unit? And it was, I thought my debate that day was good, but boy, that line really, really stole the show that day in the Civil Justice Committee. I remember it 5 or 6 years later. So it was a good argument. I think that's what Mr. Book was getting out in front of. And by all means, folks who store valuable things should receive notice. We've heard from the industry that they give the notice. And perhaps there should be more robust notice in terms of emails and calls, letters. You send a process server out, whatever you need to do, depending on the value of the things. I think that certainly notice calculated to be delivered individually to the person who stored the unit, you should exhaust all your remedies. And I suspect the industry would do that. If I was running a self-storage unit, I would want to make sure my customer paid and I didn't destroy or sell something. But in terms of Mr. Book's example, it also kind of underscores not only the financial cost of providing this notice, but also the privacy cost. You think about that. You're putting in the newspaper that so-and-so has a bunch of stuff in the storage unit and didn't pay their bill. There's a privacy cost to that as well as a financial cost. And now we're talking about embryos. I mean, that's a personal thing. I mean, there's people in this room who say there's, privacy right and reproductive freedom. I don't necessarily disagree with them in all circumstances, but certainly your medical and your IVF and your reproductive freedom, there's an informational privacy right. I'll agree with you on that. And that informational privacy right is certainly not being protected if you're going to mandate a newspaper advertisement that so-and-so left their embryos and didn't pay the bill.
Further debate? Seeing none, Representative Barrero, you recognize closing your bill.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you very much, Representative Beltran. I couldn't have said it better myself. I'll just kind of address some of the concerns over here. I think first, It's important to recognize that self-storage facility owners, they aren't profiting off of these sales. This is really to just recoup their costs. You'll get oftentimes 4, 5 months of unpaid rent, and who has to bear the cost of that? It's the self-storage facility owner. That's wrong. Oftentimes, these advertisements will cost, in addition, about $500, up to $500, to notice these things in the newspaper. It's wrong to put that cost on a non-breaching party. It's wrong to put that burden on the self-service, the self-storage owner. We've did this in the past. We've allowed municipalities to post legal notices online because we recognize that we shouldn't have to subsidize newspapers. At the end of the day, that's where the counter-arguments are coming from. The chances, think about that, the chances that the tenant receives notice in a newspaper of general circulation who happens to come about the advertisement in the classified section at the time that it's noticed are so minuscule, if existent at all. You're going to get the same result if you require it to be posted on a newspaper of general circulation. And to say that you're going to require it on both a newspaper of general circulation and to be published online, that really defeats the purpose of this bill, which is to protect the private sector and not require additional burdensome costs on small business owners. With that, I close and ask for your favorable support.
President Barrero, having closed on his bill, Julia, please call the roll on HB 283 and announce the vote.
Representatives Arrington.
No.
Beltran.
Yes.
Black.
Yes.
Campbell has been excused. Chamberlain.
Yes.
Daniels.
No.
Gant.
No.
Coster.
Yes.
Lopez.
No.
Maggard.
Yes.
Maney. McFarland.
Yes.
Overdorf.
Yes, ma'am.
Roth.
Yes.
Saroy.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Ex officio Gottlieb.
No.
Chair Robinson.
Yes.
13 yeas, 5 nays, Mr. Chair.
Please show HB 283 reported favorably as amended. Congratulations. Couldn't see Representative Tuck there. House Bill 619 by Representative Tuck, Sovereign Immunity for Professional Firms. You are recognized to explain your bill.
Sorry about that, Mr. Chair. I didn't mean to hide. Good afternoon and good afternoon, committee members. Florida Statute 768.2810 provides a list of certain private entities who are considered to be agents of the state for purposes of sovereign immunity. 768.2810E provides that professional firms providing inspection and monitoring services for state roadways and bridges in contract with FDOT enjoy sovereign immunity protection. A recent court case held that subcontractors performing the exact same services on behalf of FDOT do not enjoy the same protections. This bill seeks to provide parity for the subcontractors and the same protections. That's the bill, Mr. Chair. There is one amendment as well.
Let's go with questions on the main bill. Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Tuck, I know you and I haven't had the opportunity to talk about the bill because I just got placed on the committee. So my question is, and I am up on the bill, but my question is there the same level of supervision between the contractor, subcontractor, or developer, whoever it is, and or the DOT and the CEIs? Or the subcontractor to the CEIs?
President Tuck, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. So the way it's supposed to work in practice is that the state agency has a direct contract with the GC has a contract with the subcontractor, but there is supposed to be that contractual privity with the subcontractor to the state agency as well.
President Gott, you're recognized.
So in a perfect world, it would happen that way, but is it the intention of the bill if DOT doesn't have that same level of supervision over the subcontractor that they still get the immunity?
Representative Tuck, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. The intent of the bill is that the subcontractor performs the same services as the GC would with direct contractual privity, so they'd have the same supervision. We didn't put a direct supervision provision in the bill because the intent of the bill is really clarifying in the way that we read the language of the statute originally. We thought it covered subcontractors. This is just clarifying in our view, but I think we'd be happy to include something to that effect if it would make people feel more comfortable.
Representative Gant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Rep. Tuck, I'm sorry I didn't get back with you beforehand. My question and confusion is about the level of supervision. And I'm asking for your clarity. The subcontractors are still independent or private companies that are doing business with the government, but they don't have the same level of supervision. That's where I'm really confused about how we would extend sovereign immunity to them as private businesses who are just doing business with the government.
Representative Tuck, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. So this statute 768.28, subsection 10, provides a whole list of private entities where sovereign immunity is extended to those private entities for one reason or another. This subsection E applies to private companies who are working as contractors for inspection and monitoring purposes whenever a road or a bridge is built. So the way it works is you have state agency and company A is the general contractor. And then you have company A who subcontracts with the subcontractor for various reasons. So it's always going to be that there's a subcontractor involved for the most part. So that's where the GC, who is, you know, company A, already has that protection. The courts have ruled that, but the courts have also ruled that the subcontractor does not, even though there is a contract with the state agency as well. I know there's a lot of lines in there, so.
Representative Gant, you're recognized. Can't see you as much today.
I only had one question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
Okay, so I wrote down the little branches that you told me. So the subcontractor, would they have direct contact with the governmental agency being contracted by subcontractor A, which has a direct contract with the governmental agency?
Representative Tuck, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. Yes, the subcontractor typically has contact with the state agency. It's just not contractual privity. So the FDOT, for example, doesn't have a direct contract with contractor B, only contractor A. So there's still contact, there's just no contract.
Representative Gant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the governmental agency wanted to get rid of the subcontractor, would they have to completely eliminate their contract with the subcontractor A in order to get rid of the contract with the subcontractor?
Representative Tuck, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I would have to get more information on that. Just not knowing what those contracts look like, I don't believe the state agency would have the ability to fire the subcontractor, essentially, because there is no contractual privity, but they are performing the same services as the GC would, so that's the purpose of this bill, is to provide the same protections because the same services are being provided on behalf of the state agency.
Representative Overdorf, you're recognized.
I want to ask a question in the form of a scenario, if you will. Might help Representative Gann a little bit as well, and some others, because overall, let's say that there's a canal to be dug out there, and Company A is contracted by the government entity to dig that canal. And so they're out, and they have all the operation to be able to do that, but at the end of the day, they have to certify that canal is 12 feet deep all the way through, et cetera. So they don't have the capability of, say, having a marine surveyor to be able to do that and dig that is actually 12 feet deep all the way through. So they then contract with a marine surveyor that is a subcontractor, and currently under law, they are that subcontractor who is certifying that job is done correctly as part of the original contract is not covered by sovereign immunity, and your bill would correct that so that they are, in fact, covered by sovereign immunity, and they're part of the overall arching contract. They just happen to be paid by the guy digging the canal. Is that a correct way of saying it as well, in layman's terms?
Representative Tuck, I was going to make your question just a question mark. You're recognized, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that is correct. But just to be clear, this only covers inspections and monitoring of roadways, so it's not a broad expansion. But that is the proper scenario. Yeah.
Further questions? Representative McFarland, recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate you talking with me about this bill ahead of time. This is a question that arose out of Representative Overdorf's good example. If there was negligence on behalf of either the prime contractor or the sub in this canal scenario, it's still the case that the two answers there. So if the prime commits negligence or the sub commits negligence in this canal scenario, who would bear liability? Claims bill, blah, blah, blah. Who would bear liability?
Representative Tuck, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I may have to have you repeat the question. So if there's negligence committed on behalf of the, or by the GC and the sub?
Is that correct, Representative?
So part A, if it's the prime who commits negligence in execution of the contract, that's question number one. Question number two is, well, what if it's the sub who commits a negligent act?
You got that, Representative Tuck? You're recognized.
So. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it would be contractual at that point. So just to be clear, we're not changing anything with the GC's protections. That's always been, I think, since 2003, that's been in statute. We're just extending to the sub. And if the sub commits negligence, I believe they'd still be liable. There's certain protections built in already that we're not changing in the statute.
Further questions? Seeing none, we have an amendment. Representative Tuck, you're recognized to explain amendment barcode 638469.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment further clarifies the protections only apply to firms that are performing inspection and monitoring services on behalf of the state, and that is the amendment.
Questions on the amendment? Seeing none, do we have any public appearance cards? We are in debate. Any debate on the amendment? Seeing none, you're recognized to close your amendment.
Wave close.
Please show that amendment adopted without objection. We're back on the bill as amended. Public appearance cards. Alan Douglas, Florida Engineering Society. Sir, waves in support. J.W. Hunter, I believe it's Alaca, Florida. Waves in support. Carolyn Johnson, Florida Chamber of Commerce. Waves in support. Eric Tensom, Florida Justice Association. Sir, you're recognized.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you very much to this great subcommittee. I want to thank Rep. Tuck. She's worked with our office. She's worked with us on an informational gathering. She's had an open-door policy, and thank you for everything. She's working with us, and she sees some of the issues we see. So we're not here to say yes or no. We're here to provide some information to this subcommittee. Right now, as everyone has recognized, there is immunity, sovereign immunity, for the direct CEI. They have sovereign immunity because they are taking the role of the government in that situation. That's been the law since 2003. What this does is it extends that in several ways. So right now it's FDOT to the CEI. This changes. The first way it changes it, it's not just FDOT anymore. It's any state or its applicable subdivisions. It's not just FDOT. So I don't think this is a controversial statement. There are many municipalities throughout the state of Florida. Some have better oversight than others. Some have better policies and procedures to make sure their subs and their contractors are doing the right thing than others. It's not just FDOT anymore. So a local municipality can now create this immunity with their contractors, okay? Next, it's not just the direct contractor. It's the sub, but subbed is defined very broadly, lines 33 through 36. It says a consultant to a professional firm. The government entity is very unlikely to even know there's a consultant on this project. So now, frankly, random consultants are getting sovereign immunity. I don't know why that's happening, but I just want to point that out because we're working on these things, but we have some questions. We want to keep that conversation going. Next, I said this yesterday, I'm going to say it again. These are lucrative projects. Many people bid on every chain here. These are people that when they lose the bidding, they sue each other. That's how much they want to be CEIs or the subs of the CEIs, okay? So this isn't a situation where this cap creates more incentive or less incentive. All these people want to be involved with the process. So again, we have some concerns. We greatly appreciate the open conversations, and Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Members, we're in debate. Representative Gant, you're recognized. You don't have to raise your hand. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Tuck, I would like to, I still have some reservations, so I'll be a no today, but I would like to speak with you about it just so that I can get a lot more clarity, so that when it gets to the floor, I can be up, but just for the sake of my sensibilities and knowing what I'm voting for, I'm gonna be down today.
Ranking Member Arrington, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, we spoke earlier, and I will be a no today, but I will be seeing it in its next two stops, transportation and modals and judiciary. Sounds like you're working with the stakeholders, so hopefully it's in a better posture at the next stop, and would love to be a yes then, and look forward to talking with you more next week regarding.
Representative Beltran, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, Rep, for our conversation the other evening. Unfortunately, I'm going to be opposed to this bill, and it's not for lack of care of drafting or any lack of explanation from Rep. Tuck. Certainly, she took some time and explained the purpose of the bill very thoroughly to me. Appreciated that conversation, but I don't think it would be surprising to anyone who attends this committee that I'm just kind of philosophically opposed to sovereign immunity as a concept generally, particularly when we're expanding it to private actors and companies who are making a profit. We'll discuss it a little bit more in a later bill, but as applicable here, it's just fortuitous who you're harmed by and what remedies you'll get. If you're harmed by the government, you don't get any remedies, or you get very limited remedies. If you're harmed by a private actor who's not acting for the government, then you have all your remedies. I think that's fortuitous. It's not fair, and frankly, it puts it provides immunity to the entity that's best able to manage that risk, which is the government. The government can insure, it can require its contractors and subcontractors to insure. So we should be limiting sovereign immunity, not expanding it. Now, the purpose of this bill does have a certain appeal, and that is that you should not lose your immunity because you want to structure your transaction and engage subcontractors who perhaps can do something more efficiently or more effectively than the general contractor. That certainly has some appeal, I understand that. But the right way to put everyone on an equal playing field is to not have sovereign immunity for government contractors, not to expand it several levels below the GC. So unfortunately, I'll be opposed to the bill. Thank you.
Further debate? Seeing none, Representative Tuck, you're recognized to close in your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, thank you all so much for taking the time to speak with me and talk to me about how this bill can better be improved. We will see some amendments, I'm sure, in the next committee stop. So with that, I ask for your favorable support. Thank you.
Representative Tuck, having closed in her bill, Julia, please call the roll on HB 619 and announce the vote.
Representatives Arrington.
No.
Beltran.
No.
Black.
Yes.
Campbell has been excused. Chamberlain.
Yes.
Daniels.
Yes.
Gant.
No.
Coster.
Yes.
Lopez.
No.
Maggard.
Yes.
Maney.
Yes.
McFarland.
Yes.
Overdorf.
Yes, ma'am.
Roth.
Yes.
Saroy.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Ex officio Gottlieb.
Yes.
Chair Robinson.
Yes.
14 yeas, 4 nays, Mr. Chair.
Please show HB 619 reporter favorably as amended. Congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay. We now have bills all on members of the committee, but I see Representative Maney sitting there so patiently, so I'm going to take you next. House Bill 353. Representative Maney, you're recognized to explain your bill.
Thank you, Chairman, Vice Chairman Snyder, Ranking Member Arrington, and members of the committee. This is a simple bill. Because I'm a simple guy, I guess. In 2020, the legislature gave District Court of Appeals judges the authority to establish or designate an alternate headquarters, which would really serve as a private office, frequently in the courthouse of the county where they resided. What this bill does is it says that alternate headquarters doesn't have to be in the county where they live. Well, they also have to be more than 50 miles away for their private residence. But it says it can be in an adjacent county because the residents may be closer to the courthouse in another county. But to protect the taxpayers, it just says if you choose that option, you get paid for the shortest distance from either your county of residence or the adjacent county. It's really pretty simple. Y'all know how the court system is set up, so I'm not going to go through all that. I would just point out that there are only 71 District Court of Appeals judges in the state, so we're not talking about a large number of people who might possibly be affected. It's a real small group. And this bill has been endorsed by the Conference of District Court Judges. That's the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank Any you. Questions on Representative Meany's very simple bill? Seeing none. One public appearance card, I believe. Clay Roberts, Florida Conference of DCA Judges, waves in support. Thank you, sir. Thank you for coming. We are now in debate. Members, any debate on the bill? Seeing none, Representative Meany, you recognize closing your bill.
Wave close.
Having waved close, Julia, please call the roll on HB 353 and announce the vote.
Representatives Arrington.
Yes.
Beltran.
Yes.
Black.
Yes.
Campbell has been excused. Chamberlain.
Yes.
Daniels.
Yes.
Gant.
Yes.
Coster.
Yes.
Lopez.
Yes.
Maggard.
Yes.
Meany.
Yes, ma'am.
McFarland.
Yes.
Overdorf. Roth.
Yes.
Saroy.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Ex officio Gottlieb.
Yes.
Chair Robinson.
Yes.
17 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Please show HB 353 reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, committee.
Next up, HB 45 by Representatives Gottlieb and Coster. And they are flipping a coin here, apparently. I think Representative Gottlieb won. You are recognized to present your bill.
Thank you, Chair. I was asking Rep. Coster if she wanted to present with me from the front, but I think she's got her own bill today, so enough of the spotlight. Anyhow, I am proud to present HB 45. HB 45, members, is the Hope Card bill. There is an amendment to the bill. Would you prefer that I present the bill or the amendment?
The main bill, please. Okay. And then we'll ask questions, see if there's any questions on the main bill.
Yes, sir. So basically what happens if a petitioner for a restraining order files a restraining order and obtains a restraining order, as it stands now, the only way to prove that, if they're out in public and somebody approaches them who is the respondent to the restraining order, they can stop a law enforcement officer and they have no proof unless they're carrying the paperwork that was issued to them by the clerk of courts. What this bill does is sort of simplifies that, putting the information that is in the restraining order that has been granted into a card known as the Hope Card, so that they can simply show that to a law enforcement officer, sort of truncating the process by which the officer gathers information. Of course, the officer should trust and verify and then determine that the person has a restraining order. That is the bill, sir.
Any questions? Any questions for Representative Gottlieb? I believe Vice Chair Snyder, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the bill, Representative. Just curious, have the clerks of the Court Association weighed in on this bill?
Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I was visited by the clerk of courts this morning. I believe they are in favor of the bill. However, they are in favor of several revisions, which I have agreed to work with them on, to make the bill easier and less expensive for them to administer.
Further questions? Seeing none, I'll recognize you for your amendment. Sorry, Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized. You want more questions? You're recognized to explain your amendment, barcode 494489.
Thank you, Chair. The amendment does almost the same thing as the original bill, but was drafted with the help of Jordan Jones and your staff, and I commend him for working with us on it. Again, this bill is a work in progress. We're really trying to get to a better place. So this makes OSCA, the Office of State Courts Administrator, in charge of the administration of the bill. The Hope Card applicants must be, they have to have an availability on the website to to the clerk of courts. There is no fee to be assessed on lines 31 or 32 for the issuance of the Hope Card. It's valid for 2 years. And most importantly, I think what this amendment does is at lines 57 to 63, a person who having actual knowledge that he or she is no longer protected by the injunction and then attempts to use the Hope Card in order to get somebody in trouble, that person will be subject to a second degree misdemeanor, essentially for fraudulently using the Hope Card to try to restrain a respondent.
Any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, any public testimony on the amendment? Seeing none, any debate on the amendment? Seeing none, Representative Gottlieb, you recognize closing your amendment.
Wave close.
Having waived close, please show the amendment adopted without objection. We're back on the bill as amended. Any public appearance cards? Seeing none, we are in debate. Representative Koster, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for letting me work on this with you. I really, when you first brought it to me, I thought it was such a great idea. I do a lot of domestic violence injunction work, and having to carry around a 20-page injunction with you everywhere you go is potentially onerous, but also kind of silly, and I think this just makes it easier for the victims of domestic violence to be able to show law enforcement that they have this injunction. And so thank you for letting me work on it. I look forward to continuing to make it an even better bill.
Vice Chair Snyder, you're recognized. No debate there. Anyone else? Seeing no further debate, Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized closing your bill.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to keep it brief, but I like the bill. It's a victim-centric bill, and I think what it does is it shows that the Florida legislature has a commitment to technology as well, and it's time that we update the protections that we give to certain individuals. It is a work in progress. Today's the first committee, and I am looking forward to amending it and making it a better bill as it moves through the process. I look forward to your favorable support.
Representative Gottlieb, having closed in his bill, Julia, please call the roll on HB 4-5 and announce the vote.
Representatives Arrington.
Yes.
Beltran.
Yes.
Black.
Yes.
Campbell has been excused. Chamberlain.
Yes.
Daniels.
Yes.
Gant.
Yes.
Koster.
Yes.
Lopez.
Yes.
Maggard.
Yes.
Maney. McFarland.
Yes.
Overdorf. Roth.
Yes.
Saroy.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Ex officio Gottlieb.
Yes.
Chair Robinson.
Yes.
16 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Please show HB 45 reported favorably as amended. Next up, House Bill 521 by Representative Koster, Equitable Distribution of Marital Assets and Liabilities. Representative Koster, you're recognized to present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Robinson, Vice Chair Snyder, Ranking Member Arrington, and Committee. House Bill 521 recognizes the complexities surrounding divorce proceedings and addresses some conflicting case law regarding distribution of assets and liabilities between parties. With respect to equitable distribution, which is, for those that don't know, just a fancy phrase for how the court divides your assets and your liabilities, there's four things the court must do in every equitable distribution situation. The court must identify the marital assets and liabilities, value the assets and liabilities, distribute them to the parties, and then equalize the parties at the end. This bill does three things relating to identification, valuation, and distribution of the parties' assets and liabilities. With respect to identification, HB 521 addresses a court opinion and specifies that the gift of real property from one spouse to another has to comply with the statute of frauds, has to be in writing, has to be signed, et cetera, and so forth. Second, with respect to valuation of those assets, HB 521 provides guidelines on determining the valuation of closely held business by the spouses. And lastly, with regard to distribution of the assets, HB 521 provides a framework for interim partial distribution during the course of a dissolution action. Specifically, the bill defines the concept of extraordinary circumstances, delineating factors that the court must consider in determining whether to award an interim partial distribution. That is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Koster, having explained her bill, any questions? Seeing none, any public appearance cards, Ms. Julia? None? We are now in debate. We are in debate. Representative Koster, you're recognized to close in your bill.
I'll just wave close. I will say, this is going to bring a lot of clarity to me and my...
Representative Koster, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. Let's back up. We missed a public appearance card.
Okay.
Bonnie Sockel of the Family Law Section of the Florida Bar. Can you come a little bit closer, please? There. Thank you.
Koster, I know this is a very dry, uninteresting bill, but it is very important revisions to Florida Statute Section 61075, so thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much. And I'll give the members any debate off of that. Seeing none, Representative Koster, recognized closing your bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Bonnie, for being here. Thank you to the Family Law Section for all your hard work on putting this together. These are not sexy family law issues. There are some of those that exist, but this is not one of those, but it is still really important, and thank you for your support.
Representative Koster, having closed on her bill, Judy will please call the roll on HB 521 and announce the vote.
Representatives Arrington.
Yes.
Beltran.
Yes.
Black.
Yes.
Campbell has been excused. Chamberlain.
Yes.
Daniels.
Yes.
Gant.
Yes.
Koster.
Yes.
Lopez.
Yes.
Maggard. Maney. Maney. McFarland.
Yes.
Overdorf. Overdorf. Roth.
Yes.
Saroy.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Ex officio Gottlieb.
Yes.
Chair Robinson.
Yes.
16 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Please show HB 521 reported favorably. Next up, House Bill 41, Building Construction Regulations and System Warranties by Representative Maggard. Representative, you are recognized to explain your bill, and I recognize that there are a couple amendments that substantially change the bill. Well, let's explain the bill briefly first, and then we'll move into the amendments after questions from the committee. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm honored to present HB 481, an act relating to building construction regulations and system warranties.
Yeah, can you come a little closer there?
That's dangerous. where was I? This bill clarifies language from last year's HB 1203, that required warranties on HVA systems to initiate upon installation and warranties to transfer with the property upon sale, not with the owner. This bill also allows AC and mechanical contractors, Class A, Class B, to work on the line side of the electrical, which properly trained to do, and this will save the homeowner's time and money. That is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Any questions on the bill? Seeing none, we have two amendments. You are recognized to explain the First Amendment, barcode 858675.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill removes lines 154 through 294. The amendment removes the section of the building regarding the recuperation of attorney fees.
Any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, any public appearance cards on the amendment? Seeing none, any debate on the amendment? Seeing none, Representative Maggard, you're recognized to close the amendment.
Waive close.
Having waived close, please. I find that amendment adopted without objection. And let's move into the second amendment, which is barcode 218991.
Thank you, Chair. This amendment adds language requiring that circuit breaker locks for Class A, Class B, air conditioning contractors, and mechanical contractors. This will ensure that the power isn't accidentally turned on while the contractors are working on the electrical. That is the amendment.
Any questions on the amendment? Seeing no questions, we'll move into public appearance cards on the amendment. Jeff Sharkey, National Electrical Contractors Association. This is on the amendment. You are recognized, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman, Minority Leader. I just want to thank Representative Maggard for our conversations we've been having. We represent the National Electrical Contractors Association. Obviously very concerned about the safety considerations in wiring. One of the issues we've been discussing is electrical contractors have the authority to work on the line side. I won't bore you with the whole thing. And we believe that AC contractors could work on the load side, on the other side of the thing. But I think the amendment may provide some resolution for us. And so we're continuing to work with him and appreciate his openness and willingness to chat. So thank you.
Thank you. Teresa King, Florida Building and Construction Trades Council. Ma'am, you're recognized, and this is on the amendment, correct?
Correct.
And I have you down five times. Do you want to speak on the main bill as well?
Yes, please.
Okay. You're recognizing the amendment.
Five times. Sorry about that. Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair, committee members. Teresa King, Florida Building and Construction Trade Council. But I stand before you today also as a trade electrician, journeyman wireman. Thank you, Representative Maggard, for opening up your office to address our concerns. The first line of defense is always protection of the worker, and we do believe by this amendment to add a breaker lock on the line side will be one step in helping the dangers that could have been, we want to prevent, any accidents by this line side lock. So thank you very much, and we do support the amendment.
That's all the public appearance cards I have on the amendment. Any debate on the amendment? Seeing none, Representative Maggard, you're recognized to close in your amendment.
Waived closed, Chair.
Having waived closed, please show the amendment adopted without objection. We're on the bill as amended. Public appearance cards. Edward Briggs, Florida Refrigeration, Air Conditioning, and Contracting Association. Waves in support. Teresa King, back up. Florida Building and Construction Trade Council, you're back up testifying on the main bill. As amended.
Yes, thank you for that. And on the main bill, again, the amendment for the security breaker lock will be wonderful. I do request that I have one more opportunity to come between you and the stakeholder as well on this bill for just one more line of protection that we know that then we can fully support this bill and help it become law. Thank you.
Thank you. That's all I have for public appearance cards. Members, we are in debate. Seeing none, Representative Maggard, you're recognized to close your bill.
Wave close.
Having waived close on his bill, Julia, please call the roll on HB 481 and announce the vote.
Representatives Arrington.
Yes.
Beltran.
Yes.
Black.
Yes.
Campbell has been excused. Chamberlain.
Yes.
Daniels.
Yes.
Gant.
Yes.
Coster.
Yes.
Lopez.
Yes.
Maggard.
Yes.
Maney. McFarland.
Yes.
Overdorf. Roth.
Yes.
Saroy. Smith.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Ex officio Gottlieb.
Yes.
Chair Robinson.
Yes.
16 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Please show HB 481 reported favorably as amended. Next up, HB 799 by Representative Robinson. Easements affecting real property owned by the same owner. I shall pass the gavel to the Vice Chair, now Chair.
Thank you, Chairman. Representative Robinson, you are recognized to present your bill, House Bill 799, easements affecting real property owned by same owner.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Ranking Member. This bill was actually brought to me by the Florida Real Property and Probate and Trust Section. It's not often we get a terrible court decision in real estate law that impacts my industry and our industry, but we did, and so this bill seeks to correct that. This bill reiterates and clarifies existing law and expressly validates the creation of easements, servitudes, and other interests in real property, notwithstanding that at the time of creation, all the affected real property is under common ownership. That is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Having explained the bill, are there questions on the bill? Seeing no questions and no amendments, is there public testimony on the bill? French Brown, representing the Real Property Probate Trust Law Section of the Florida Bar, is a proponent. Waiving in support. That is all the public testimony we have on the bill. Members, anyone wishing to debate on the bill? Seeing no debate, Chairman Robinson, you're recognized to close on your bill.
I'll waive close, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Julia, please call the roll.
Representatives Arrington.
Yes.
Beltran.
Yes.
Black.
Yes.
Campbell has been excused. Chamberlain.
Yes.
Daniels.
Yes.
Gant.
Yes.
Coster. Lopez.
Yes.
Maggard.
Yes.
Maney. McFarland.
Yes.
Overdorf. Roth.
Yes.
Saroy. Smith.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Ex officio Gottlieb.
Yes.
Chair Robinson.
Yes.
16 yeas, 0 nays, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Show House Bill 799 reported favorably, and I yield the gavel back.
Surprised I got it back. Okay, here we go. Thank you. Great job. Very efficient. Next up, PCS for House Bill 569 by Representative McFarland, suits against the government. Representative McFarland, you're recognized to explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it must be Thursday afternoon after lasagna for lunch. But we're going to wake up here, folks. The concept of sovereign immunity comes from the English king being shielded against accountability to his filthy commoner subjects. The king can do no wrong. And it is in the American character to be highly skeptical of sovereigns, but we're also very skeptical of taxes. So although we've retained some portion of sovereign immunity, we've made it, so our sovereigns are not immune from us, we've made it difficult to sue the sovereign in cases of negligence. PCS for House Bill 569 increases the sovereign immunity caps for damages against state and local government entities to $400,000 per individual and $600,000 per incident. It calls for an annual CPI adjustment and reduces the statute of limitations from 4 to 2 years. It increases the statute of limitations, however, for cases of sexual battery against a minor under the age of 16, up to 15 years after the age that they reach, after they turn 18. It allows a local government to settle a claim and pay the settled amount without the need for a claim bill, and it prohibits an insurance policy from requiring a claim bill before payout. It abolishes the common law doctrine of home venue privilege in relation to suits against the state, and I'll point out that this bill has an October 1st, 2024 effective date, as opposed to our normal July 1st effective date, and that's to match with the typical fiscal year of local governments. That, Mr. Chair, is the bill.
Having explained the bill, any questions? Any questions for Representative McFarland? Representative Koster, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Rep, for the bill. Definitely in support. I have a question on the statute of limitations issue. I know we're moving it from 4 years to 2 years. I'm okay with that. But my understanding is with sovereign immunity claims, there's a pre-suit notice requirement, which then sort of eats into maybe about 6 months of the statute of limitations. So I'm wondering, I know in, I think, Med-Mal lawsuits that also have a similar pre-suit notice requirement, we toll the statute of limitations. Is that something, does this bill do that?
Representative McFarland, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Koster. You're right, the bill, so I mentioned at the start that the bill reduces the statute of limitations from 4 years to 2 years. That's to align us with our tort reform package that we did last year and try to make suits against a sovereign as equal to suits against a private citizens as possible. So we're gonna match that there. I do understand it's unique when you sue a government, there's a 6 month waiting period there, and I see how that creates a disparity between a private suit and a suit against a sovereign. The good thing about the committee process, you know, we're at the stage of session where we notice a bill and everyone, you know, flurries to read it because there's so many bills that have been filed and we have good ideas that come forward, and I think this is just such one of them. And that's an area that I'm looking forward to working on as the bill moves forward.
Further questions? Seeing none, we'll move into public testimony. Jess M. McCarthy of the Miami-Dade County County Attorney's Office waives in opposition. Thank you, sir. Marty Cassini, Broward County, waives in opposition. Bob McKee, Florida Association of Counties, waives in opposition. David Cruz, Florida League of Cities. Mr. Cruz, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is David Cruz of the Florida League of Cities, and I am in the unenviable position of being up here in opposition to the sponsor's bill. I have a tremendous amount of respect to the sponsor, and I'm very thankful to the time that she allocated to discuss the bill prior to this committee. I am hopeful that we could work on addressing some of our concerns as the bill moves through the process. I briefly, though, wanted to outline some of those concerns. When we're talking about caps, our members strongly feel that caps are important in Florida. They're an incredibly necessary function to help our taxpayers keep costs down. However, we recognize that this is a policy decision that the Florida legislature gets to make. And so having this discussion in this committee room is an appropriate function, and we are committed to work on that discussion as the bill moves through the process. However, just keep in mind when we're talking about caps that Florida's governments, especially our cities, provide several essential services. Things like fire, police, water, sewer, roads, all of those are essential to our Floridians. And unlike the private sector, we can't adjust our delivery of those services to limit liability. We can't change our business model. We can't have a firefighter ask you to sign a waiver to limit liability before they run into a burning building. And so just keep that in mind as we work on this issue. And at the end of the day is, look, we have over 100 cities in Florida who have a budget of less than $5 million. You could see how large claims could literally bankrupt those cities. And so caps are absolutely necessary. What those caps should be set at is a conversation we're willing to engage at and continue to have that conversation as it moves forward. Let me just briefly touch on two provisions in the bill that I really wanna work on as the bill moves. And one of those is dealing with CPI or tying the caps to CPI. Like I mentioned previously, having this discussion in this committee room right now is completely appropriate. Having caps automatically go up is something that gives our members a lot of concerns. We feel that that is a legislative function that all of you should be making, that we should be making in this room and publicly vetting that conversation. And so we would love to see that CPI provision removed from the bill and for the Florida legislature to set caps for sovereign immunity in Florida. I tried to look at other states. I had a really hard time finding others that do it this way with CPI. I only found Colorado, and even they do it every 4 years. I would suggest that's not a model we should follow, and it makes it extremely administratively difficult for us to implement the CPI, given our insurance policies run from October 1 to September 30th, but yet the CPI would be coming out on July 1st in the middle of the insurance policy. The second thing I wanted to point out is the bill ties these new caps to the date of final judgment. And that is extremely concerning for us, and let me explain why. If you were to go to City Hall today and you were to slip and fall, caps today in Florida are set at $200,000 for that individual slip and fall accident. However, if you filed a claim and you litigated that claim, it might be 2 to 3 years before you get to a jury verdict. The bill would say that the claims that are in place 3 years later, after you slipped and fell, would be the ones that controlled. Our insurance policy wouldn't cover the increased amount that the claims that the caps had changed, and so we really think that the caps should be set to the date the accident happened. The date when you slipped and fell should be the caps that are in place for that claim. And so just as you move forward, look, I realize this is the first stop. It's the first week of session. The committee process is going to work, and we're going to keep our commitment to the sponsor of the bill to work on these issues. But just don't lose sight of the fact that at the end of the day, we're dealing with taxpayer dollars. It's just incredibly important that our cities, like many of you, want to keep our taxes low. And so we would ask that you enact policies that help us keep our taxes low for our Floridians in our cities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. Bob Harris, Panhandle Area Education Consortium.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, again, my name is Bob Harris, and I have the honor and privilege of representing the Panhandle Area Educational Consortium. For those of you that don't know, the consortium is statutorily created, and it's all the small and rural school districts that are west of here, all the way to Walton County, Madison, Taylor County, those kinds of places. I serve as both the general counsel for the consortium as well as the attorney, and the reason I say this is because when they get sued, I'm the one who gets that phone call. Some cases like this come up. I have probably 35 or 40, unfortunately, sitting on my desk. We're opposed to this bill, but I want to explain why, and I very much appreciate David Cruz's points. I'm not going to repeat those points. He made some very good points about the CPI and some other things, so I won't repeat those, but let me tell you why. We can't afford this. We just cannot afford this. Insurance cost is one of the biggest costs we have as a small school district, small school districts, and all of our districts are very small. For example, Liberty County, if you raise taxes by $1 million, it brings in a whopping $375,000 new dollars. That's how much. Dade County is in the millions, but we can't afford this. So when you talk about increasing the caps, doubling those caps, our insurance rates are going to go up. In all of our school districts, we have a self-insurance fund. Every dollar that we pay out on claims is a dollar out of our taxpayers, dollar for dollar. And so we can't afford, if you double the caps, our insurance rates are going to go through the roof, and small school districts, we just can't do that. And as David said, the way the bill's written, it's going to go up by CPI every year. So it's going to increase every year. There's another way to do that. I'll offer that alternative in just a second. There will be more claims. We call it the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow syndrome. If you increase the amount available, there will be more claims. We know that. We talked to other lawyers who ask us, you know, when will this ever be increased? We're ready to file more claims. We know that will happen, and we just can't afford that either. Some people have said, in response to this, that public entities like school districts should be treated just like common tortfeasors. We are not Walmart. We are not Amazon, and we never will be, and let me tell you why. This legislature requires us to provide services to people in our communities, school buses, thousands of miles every day. We have to open up, we have to have PE classes. We have to have field trips. We invite people to our ball games, to our football fields and our basketball courts. We cannot close them. And I have cases sitting on my desk right now today where people have sued us because if something happened in our basketball courts, on our football fields, during field trips, and our school buses. And so, unlike Walmart and Amazon or other companies, we have to do these things. We have to open our doors. And so we need to be treated differently, not just like any other tortfeasor. Please keep that in mind. It's very important. I think the claims bill process does work. And this is just after being here in the legislature for 40 years and I used to defend claims bills. Let me tell you this. It's just kind of philosophical, I guess. You are the woe button. You all are the woe button for claims. The way the claims bill process works, it says, look, people want money from taxpayers, and we're going to use this process to say at some point in time, we're going to give people money because their claim entitles it. But because you're in charge of the budget, all that money, you're the only one that can put a woe on it to say, no, we've got to look at other things that we're doing and how we're using our resources. If you just keep increasing that cap rate every time, put the cost back on us, and kind of get rid of the claims bill process, it's going to be very difficult, and I think you're taking away a great authority and power that you have. And the last thing I'll say is this. There is a provision there which says, allows us to settle beyond the insurance amounts that we have. The first thing we get anytime anyone wants to sue our school district is a letter saying, tell us your insurance policy. We send it to them. But this provision here would allow someone to sue us well beyond those things. I cannot negotiate resolution of claims against our school districts if that language is in there, because they're going to start at millions of dollars. They do already with our insurance policy. You know what our insurance limit is? They said that's what it'll be. That's what we're settling for, nothing less. If you have this provision there, it's going to go beyond that. We just cannot afford this. And I ask you to reconsider this. We'll work with the sponsor on some of these things. The CPI, for example, I don't think the CPI should be in there. Let's do it every 5 years. Let's come back every 5 years and take a look at it. That's reasonable. Let's take a look at it. Maybe the CPI has gone up, it's gone down. Let's take a look at it. Let's do that rather than an automatic. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you.
Thanks, sir. Matthew Posgay, Florida Justice Association.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative McFarland, thank you so much for working on this bill. We are thankful for this bill. It helps right wrongs done to citizens. When, with all due respect, talking about a pot of gold when somebody's been permanently injured makes no sense to me at all. My clients that I represent that I've been doing on the plaintiff's side for over 15 years would rather give the money back and have their health back and not be permanently hurt for the rest of their lives. What this bill does is a good compromise. I'd love to have the numbers. We don't have that ability. You all have worked on a good compromise to get fair numbers. As far as the CPI issue, heck, if it had been done every 5 years, we'd be much higher because in the past 50 years, just the cost of medical care has more than doubled. It would be more than double what the caps are here right now. So. They haven't changed for 13 years. And then to say, well, don't change it, but if you are going to change it with CPI, do it every 3 or every 5, doesn't make sense. This is something to help the citizens, your constituents who have been harmed permanently, and this is a fair compromise, and we thank you so much for working with all the stakeholders to reach something that is reasonable in this situation. Thank you.
Thanks, sir. Mark Dalligal, Safety Net Hospital Alliance. You're recognized.
Good Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Mark Delegal, and I'm the general counsel to the Safety Net Hospital Alliance of Florida. Our members include your legacy teaching hospitals, your public hospitals, your children's hospitals, and your RIPIC hospitals. Our membership consists of eight facilities, or eight systems with many facilities that enjoy sovereign immunity. This would be, you've heard, a cost driver. Let me share with you a result of an actuarial study that our group prepared just to itemize the costs, but also want to reiterate that it's more than just the cost of the change of numbers that are involved here. We commissioned Willis Towers Watson to look at what the cost of this bill would be on the sovereign entities that I represent, in addition to the state-supported medical schools, the likes of the University of Florida, the University of South Florida, FAU, FSU, et cetera. And this would increase the estimated cost, and this is a very conservative estimate, I'd be happy to go into the more details, would be $107 million a year. Now, that's $107 million a year, that's real money, and what that will have to come out of something that we're already spending money on, and we will reduce service, we will reduce pay, we will reduce whatever it is in order to be able to be able to afford the insurance. And that's a conservative estimate. That is not estimate, is not considered increased frequency. And as was mentioned earlier, when there's a bigger pot of money available, I use this phrase, when the honey pot is bigger, there'll be more bears coming for it. So I know my fraternity brother there, Matthew, probably doesn't like me using that, but that's how I say it. The other thing I want to point out, there's many other things in the bill than the number. The number gets a lot of attention, and I can't argue with the fact that the number's been static for 13 years, and before that it was static for another 10 years, and before that it was static for another 10 years. The number is one conversation, but this bill is a wholesale rewrite of the sovereign immunity process, and it has a untold financial cost on all of the sovereigns. So if we were here talking about numbers, I think you'd have a different conversation. But this bill has a number of things that have been pointed out by David, been pointed out by Bob, that are really going to impact us, and we just don't know how. In life, you know, when you negotiate with anybody about anything, leverage is key. This bill flips the leverage dramatically. And when leverage flips in negotiation, every lawyer on this panel knows what that means. That means the check gets bigger. And that's what's going to happen here. It'll have to play out. And so I would really urge us, if we're going to talk about numbers, that's a fair conversation that I know my folks and other folks that are part of our coalition that includes about 50 sovereign entities that are with us here would love to have and will have with the sponsor. But there's a number of provisions that are really problematic. They're nuanced. They're not very sexy. They're not very exciting to discuss. The numbers are easier and more interesting to say, just change the numbers. So with all that, I want to thank you. I spoke to the sponsor just after she filed the bill, so she knew we were concerned, and we'll keep working with you. Thank you.
Thanks, sir. Eric Tinsman, Florida Justice Association. Sir, you're recognized.
Thank you. I'm back. Rep. McFarland, thank you so much for raising these antiquated caps. 200, 300 is just too low. 400, 600, obviously we all wish they were higher on our end, but 400, 600 is a fair compromise, a fair number, and thank you. This is going to change people who are seriously injured by the government through no fault of their own, and they're going to be able to get some money. And they didn't want this. They would love to be able to sue a private entity, but the person who injured them was the government, and now they can get up to $400,000 with this bill, so thank you. It's been a long time coming, and it's a fair number. This bill also streamlines the claims bill process. That will lead to less litigation, because right now, even if the local municipality wants to pay the verdict, they can't, because the insurance policies are written in a way that says we will never pay until there's a claims bill. So there's every incentive to fight post-verdict, because there's a long lag time between verdict and claims bill. There's litigation going on during that time. This allows the local municipality to go to their insurance that they have already paid for and get it paid without a claims bill, without further litigation. This will reduce litigation on the bigger claims, the more serious claims. I know you've all heard the story of the officer on Daytona Beach who was drinking and ran somebody over on the beach. Cases like that, the really horrific cases, that woman is not going to have to wait 15 years to get paid because there's a claims bill process. Daytona Beach is going to be able to, if they want to, avail themselves to the insurance that they already have. And this bill removes the requirement that the insurance won't pay until there's a claims bill. That's a very important streamlined process that reduces litigation. It is critical to this bill. So thank you, Rep. McFarland. These changes will enhance government accountability. We've all been in parts of Florida where there's just pothole after pothole after pothole. And there's a reason for that, because their worst day is $200,000. Now their worst day is $400,000. Maybe those potholes get fixed. Related to, I know the person who spoke right before me, he used a big number, and I haven't seen his numbers. I'd love to delve into them, but 107 million, I think he said. Sounds like a big number, but when you look at some of these hospitals, their revenues are 2.2, 2.8 billion every single year. Jackson, 2.2 billion, okay? So 107, even if his numbers are right, 107 million sounds like a big number. These sovereign hospitals are doing just fine. Thank you very much. Thank you for your time and attention, and thank you for raising these caps. God bless.
That's all the public appearance cards I have. Members, we are in debate. Vice Chair Snyder, you're up first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative McFarland, for the bringing this bill forward. I think as we had the conversation today, certainly some concerns came to light. I think that, you know, when we look at the CPI and just letting that just be baked into the cake is a slippery slope. And so I look forward to having that conversation. And if there's one thing I know about the bill sponsor, she is a good faith operator. We look forward to seeing hopefully some changes. I am going to support the bill today in hopes that we do see changes, because if we did get to the judiciary stop in the current form, I would not be able to. So again, look forward to those conversations, and we'll be up on the bill today.
Representative Beltran, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman, and thank you for everyone for a robust discussion this afternoon. Rep. McFarland, in her introduction, she spoke about the origin of the doctrine of sovereign immunity and talked about the divine right of kings and the king can do no wrong and all of that mumbo jumbo that we don't believe in anymore because we fought a war. We fought a war about that a quarter of a millennium ago. We said we don't believe in the divine right of kings. We believe in a constitutional republic. And so what is the role of sovereign immunity in a constitutional republic? Well, the only possible justification for sovereign immunity in a constitutional republic is separation of powers. It's an argument. No one, people have made all kinds of arguments today. They didn't make the best argument that they could have made, which is separation of powers. So I'm going to make it for you. I'm going to tell you why it's wrong. The argument would be that the courts and attorneys should not be appropriating taxpayer money in the form of a judgment against the state because that's the province of the legislature. The Constitution commits spending to the legislature, and it's the people's elected representatives who are supposed to make spending decisions. That's what sovereign immunity is about in the United States. That's the only possible justification. But it doesn't hold up on the system that we have. Somebody mentioned claim bills. What's a claim bill? That's when the court's done its job. The case has either gone to settlement or it's gone to judgment. There's been a jury trial. There's been a summary judgment, whatever it is. There's a claim in excess or a verdict, judgment in any event, in excess of the sovereign immunity cap. And somebody comes to this committee and they say, we want more money. And now we're sitting as an ad hoc appellate court over what that court did, the judgment that they entered, and we're essentially doing what's an implicit additor or a remittitor motion. We're either saying we're going to go over the cap, how much are we going to go over the cap? Usually we compromise the claim bill, so we're saying, well, here is a judgment for X million dollars. We're going to pay you 0.6 of X because we're going to compromise it, and then we're going to do something about the attorney fees as well. That's what we're doing. How is that accomplishing separation of powers? That puts us, not all of us are lawyers. We haven't heard the case. We designate one of the judiciary staff as a special master to look at the details of the case, and then we give the claim bill 5 minutes. How is that? How is that being a good steward of taxpayer money, making sure people are compensated and in an appropriate manner? It's a broken system, and that's why myself and Rep. McFarland and other people have been working on this issue for such a long time. There was a suggestion from the audience that we should review this every 5 or 10 years, and that was in reference to the CPI issue. But the fact of the matter is it's been over a decade since we've raised the caps. The caps were inadequate back in 2010. They've been inadequate because there's been inflation the entire time. Rep. Juan Fernandez-Barquin brought this bill 4 years ago. I supported it. I ran it the last two sessions, and now Rep. McFarland's running it, and there's still opposition, so I don't know if we're going to get it done this year. In the last 4 years since we've even been working on the issue, there's been double-digit inflation. So when you say, don't do the CPI, let's wait and do this every 5 or 10 years, what basically you're saying is that we're always going to have caps that are inadequate. We're always going to be playing catch-up. But when we do raise the caps, we don't even raise them enough. We end up with a compromise where it's not the full amount of the inflation. Now, we talk about the people said, you know, that the claims are going to go up. The amount of claims are going to go up. What you're really saying is that there are people now who are being injured who aren't getting compensated because it's impractical to make the claims, or it's not economical for the attorneys to take the claims. That you're saying that you're not compensating people now who deserve to be compensated, who if the caps go up a little bit, then maybe they can eke out a claim. That's really what you're saying. And the incidence of these damages, nobody chooses to be injured by the government. We provide fire, we provide police, we provide school buses. You happen to get hit. All the taxpayers of that county are paying taxes. All the school children, all of us are being protected by the police and the fire department. And then there's one guy, he happens to be crossing the street and he gets hit. And the entire burden that you've obviated by not having the right insurance or not being subject to the limits, it falls on one individual person. And then there's the argument about the leverage, that we're going to give too much leverage to the claimants. I'll tell you that when you bring a claim against the government, you have almost no leverage. The adjusters at the CFO's office, they're impossible to deal with. You could say they're very good stewards of taxpayer dollars. They have a lot of leverage because there are low limits. Most people don't know about claim bills. They don't think they can get them. The government's a repeat player. They have every incentive to grind you into the ground. I think they're tough. I think I'm tough, but I think they're tough. And it gives me pause to bring these claims. I'm still going to have pause to bring these claims. So I think this bill is a really good compromise. If I were in the industry or I were representing one of these local governments, I would want to take this bill. I would want to take these limits because these are very generous limits. Rep. McFarland set the level very low. It's a lot lower than what I've put in my bills. You all know that. And you said to me privately, we'd love to have you lowered it to these limits. We would be happy to accept the bill or not oppose the bill. And then here you have this great bill. I would lock this in, lock these rates in for the next 13 years. You'd be doing a very good job for your taxpayers. Thank you.
Representative Gottlieb, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Chair. If Rep. Beltran and I continue to agree, you may see the emergence of a new law firm. but I agree. I mean, first of all, the whole concept of sovereign immunity is classist. That's really, you know, where it comes from, is that the king could do no wrong. And therefore, you couldn't sue the king because he wasn't going to sit in judgment of himself. And as my colleague said, when this country was formed, we moved away from that system because we wanted say in our legislative process. But we wrestle here because we don't want our cities to go bankrupt, and I understand that. But I think 400, 600, it's low, but it's a step absolutely in the right direction. And I agree that there's many lawyers who won't take these cases at the threshold that they're at now, yet we have people who are suffering grievous injuries. And so I do think that, you know, maybe these municipalities, and I don't want them to get hurt, but when we're hearing about a small school district that has 40 pending lawsuits, maybe they ought to look at how they're operating. Because maybe the threshold is so low
that we aren't deterring negligence. And I don't want anybody to get sued, but I think that when we look at the system that we have now, as Rep. Beltran said earlier today, if you suffer an unfortunate injury or death, you want it to be at the hands of a private actor, and because you can sue. It's strange. The same accident by a private actor and then by a sovereign immunity, you can only get $200,000 now. Everything about it is wrong, because it might not even be enough to compensate you to live your life the way you could have or should have. I think the numbers are low. I agree with the CPI. I hate to say that to the cities, because I'd like to be in lockstep with the cities. And that's, I talk about this often when we're up here. We wrestle with who we are supposed to serve. And it makes decisions like this very difficult. But I still don't think the numbers are where they should be. So for me, at this point in time, it's an easy decision to vote up on this bill, and I urge you to do so.
Further debate? Seeing none, Representative McFarland, you're recognized to close in your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm tremendously tempted to wave, but I won't give up the opportunity to talk. I have to give credit here to Representative Beltran. I care about this issue, and I'm sponsoring the bill because he brought it to my attention, and this committee staff did when we did a workshop on it last session. And the reason why I'm sponsoring this bill, I'm not an attorney. I don't work in this area. A government has never committed negligence against me or a family member. It's not personal to me, but it is personal because I sat up here for an entire session. I heard claims bill after claims bill, and it broke my heart. And I understand now why it felt so strange to me. Representative Beltran explained why. I'm a legislator. I own the purse strings. I'm used to giving money or not giving money. And now, as I sat in this committee and I heard a terrible story after terrible story, and I looked at the amount of money that they were getting in settlement, and I thought, that is not enough for a life that's been ruined, frankly. Another part of this bill that has my attention is that damages in cases of against the sovereign, they're compensatory. They're not punitive. The sovereign is not punished with an astronomical settlement amount or judgment amount. It's compensatory to restore that person, whether they've lost a life or a limb or property. And that feels right. I want my government to restore me if they commit a crime against me, or they commit negligence against me. As I sat up here, claims bill after claims bill, or I hear a local government's argument about the cost going up, I know they will. I've worked in business. I'm usually a complete free market person. I'm usually very friendly to the Chamber of Commerce. I'm very friendly to my local government. But you can buy more insurance, and I know that will drive up my cost rate. And I represent Sarasota. Many of my local governments are self-insured. My hospital, where my three children were born, is self-insured. I know that this means costs will go up a little bit, but if one of my three children who was born at this public hospital happens to get hit by a pickup truck that has a county emblem on the side of the door instead of just a personally owned vehicle, I have to wait years and years to come before the legislature with a claims bill and just hope and pray we happen to have a legislature who wants to hear a claims bill, because that wasn't the case for a number of years. That's hard for me. It's sad for me. I don't want that for myself. I don't want it for my citizens. That's why I'm bringing this bill. I write my own bills. This is a proposed committee substitute today because I wrote a couple things that didn't really make sense, and we've had to amend the bill. I put a CPI, automatic CPI adjuster in there because I didn't want to have to wait 13 years to come back and adjust the cost. I hope that it would flow with the market. Now I understand that often ideas that are very good on paper or on a PowerPoint don't play out in practice. This is an element I'm very willing to work on. I talked in response to a question from Representative Koster about working on a tolling provision to allow the appropriate amount of time. Like, I want to make this a good bill, but I also want to make it easy for me to have restitution if something horrible were to happen to me at the hands of a local government. I think the win-win-win bills have all been taken. There are no easy solutions in this difficult job we do. I understand that. I know that I don't have all of your support, and I know I will not have unanimous support going forward with this bill. I support this bill. I'm asking you to support it, too. Thank you.
Representative McFarland, having closed in her bill, Julia, please call the roll on PCS for HB 569 and announce the vote.
Representatives Arrington.
Yes.
Beltran.
Yes.
Black.
Yes.
Campbell has been excused. Chamberlain.
Yes.
Daniels.
Yes.
Gant.
Yes.
Coster.
Yes.
Lopez.
Yes.
Maggard.
Yes.
Maney.
No.
McFarland.
Yes.
Overdorf.
Yes, ma'am.
Roth.
Yes.
Saroy.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Ex officio Gottlieb.
Yes.
Chair Robinson.
Yes.
17 yeas, one nay, Mr. Chair.
Please show PCS for HB 569 reported favorably. Congratulations. Members, if there is no further business, this concludes our agenda for today. Representative Coster moves we rise. Unless there's an objection upon the motion of Representative Coster, this meeting is adjourned.